It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Democrat John Ossoff nearly won last month's 18-candidate special election to succeed Republican Tom Price in the U.S. House from the 6th Congressional District north of Atlanta. Now Ossoff faces Republican Karen Handel in the June 20th runoff, and John Ossoff joins us now. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Dennis. Great to be here.
As we speak, Congress is still digesting the story, which started with the Washington Post, which says that President Trump, perhaps without meaning to, disclosed classified information to Russia's foreign minister and ambassador to the U.S. Most legal experts that we've heard from so far say that if the story is true, the president did not do anything illegal, however imprudent it might have been. You agree?
Well, the president does have broad authority to declassify information. Of course, I don't know specifically what may or may not have been said in the Oval Office, but every official of the U.S. government has a solemn obligation to protect the confidentiality of sources and methods with respect to intelligence gathering.
And it appears that the president, if what General McMaster said is true, the National Security Advisor, did not divulge any sources.
Well, it's the kind of thing that I think needs a careful look from Congress. A useful first step would be for the Senate Intelligence Committee, perhaps in a closed session if necessary, to discuss classified matters. Could hear from the heads of the CIA and the NSA to determine precisely what may have been disclosed.
The Russia relationship is a complicated one, but since they are on the same side as the U.S. in the war on ISIS, and since that appears to be what the subject of the discussion was with the ambassador and the foreign minister, isn't it appropriate to share intelligence with them?
Well, the question will be whether or not the information that was shared might allow the Russians to determine classified nature of sources and methods in U.S. intelligence gathering. When sources and methods aren't protected, that can damage intelligence sharing relationships with our intelligence partners. That can undermine the secrecy of technical means of intelligence collection for signals intelligence, for example, and it can put the lives of human sources at risk.
But should the president's discussions with a foreign power be something that Congress gets involved in? The president has wide latitude when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, I think it would be reasonable and within congressional oversight prerogatives for the intelligence committees to ask some questions, given what was reported. Given the sensitivity of a subject matter, it would also be reasonable for those sessions to initially be closed to ensure the protection of classified information.
The aviation information that the president discussed with the ambassador and the foreign minister, at least according to General McMaster, had already been shared with multiple allies. So the question could fairly be asked, given that we don't know a lot, what's the harm here?
Well, the question is whether or not the nature of the information that was disclosed might allow a foreign power to draw conclusions or inferences about sources and methods of intelligence gathering or classified intelligence sharing relationships that the U.S. has with foreign intelligence services and foreign governments.
You've called for an independent counsel to look into the Trump campaign's possible connections to Russian officials, and this is apart from the most recent developments. Why not allow the current Intelligence Committee investigations to continue? You've just talked about the value of those in looking into what just happened with the Russian ambassador and foreign minister.
Well, when it comes to the possibility that a foreign intelligence service deliberately interfered in the U.S. election, and that is something that the U.S. intelligence community has publicly stated, it's critically important that the American public has a full understanding of what happened and that we prevent it from happening again. And it's such a hot-button issue politically that I think we need an independent investigation to ensure that as we seek to determine what happened, that those conclusions are not politicized.
But those committee investigations are already underway. They may have uncovered things, again, behind closed doors that we don't even know about. An independent counsel would take a long time to set up and to get running. Why not continue with what we're already doing, especially in the Senate, the chair and ranking member appear to be working together?
Well, I think that the credibility of Congress, no matter which party is in charge, to conduct truly independent investigations of politically sensitive matters is somewhat in doubt right now. If Congress were to commission an independent committee to investigate it, perhaps more along the lines of what happened after 9/11, that might be a reasonable approach to ensure greater independence. But I also think that the appointment of a special prosecutor would be prudent given the stakes here. We're talking about the possibility that a foreign power meddled in the American political system in a way that's completely inappropriate. It needs to be above partisanship and above politics. It's a matter of patriotism and national security.
But the independent counsel or a special prosecutor would be appointed by members of Congress.
Well, you know, the government is run by elected officials. And what we need to do is to ensure that whether it is a special prosecutor or it's a commission that Congress sets up, that that prosecutor or those who are leading that commission have the kind of credibility and reputation for independence necessary to demonstrate to the public the seriousness with which the authorities are pursuing the truth here.
Do you think President Trump is competent to hold office?
Well, there are many in this community, myself among them, who have concerns about this administration's level of competence, about the honesty with which the White House approaches the press and the public. Recent events have not done a great deal to ease those concerns. But my sincere hope is that he exercises sound judgment and that those around him guide the administration in a direction that serves the American people.
If you were in the House right now, would you push for the House to at least consider impeachment at
this
point?
We're there. I don't think we're there. I think that we need a full and transparent and independent assessment of what level of interference there was by Russian intelligence services in the U.S. election. Those facts need to be fully determined, and overseers in Congress or any independent counsel or commission established to do so should follow those facts wherever they lead.
Let's talk about health care for a moment. It's a big part of the debate in this race. The Senate Republicans right now are working on a health care plan that will probably be much different than that passed by the House. One possible idea, give Americans tax credits based on income rather than age so that they could buy insurance. This is a Republican idea. Do you think it's a good one?
Well, here are the basic principles that I think should apply. No American should suffer or die from treatable or preventable illness. No one should go broke because they get sick. And no business should have to lay off employees or downsize because it can't keep up with increasing premiums.
But isn't – I'm sorry to interrupt you on that. Aren't premiums going up no matter what?
They're
already going up under Obamacare.
And that's exactly why what Congress should be doing is working on a bipartisan basis to control costs and to make insurance more affordable. Unfortunately, what passed the House doesn't achieve that goal. I think it was a piece of legislation that was motivated more by partisan objectives than policy objectives, would have thrown a lot of people off their health insurance, will deny protection to folks with pre-existing conditions if it becomes law. I hope that folks in the Senate will take an approach that serves the public interest rather than the political interests of folks in D.C.
One of the ideas is to get rid of the mandates. Do you think that's a good idea? The mandate that people get coverage.
If you're going to have the kinds of consumer protections, for example, for those with pre-existing conditions that the Affordable Care Act does offer, you have to expand the insurance pool so that there are significant resources to offer those protections. I'm open to considering any alternative means of doing that. I just haven't seen one proposed.
Wouldn't one idea be allowing more people to get perhaps basic coverage, but at least coverage against catastrophic illness if they were able to buy insurance across state lines? That's another idea the Republicans have floated.
And that's something that I would be eager to work with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to pursue. I think that there should be greater competition in the insurance market. I think the fact that insurance companies compete only within the narrow borders of our states means that consumers have fewer choices, prices are too high, and quality isn't as high as it could be.
Realistically, though, do you think it is even honest to tell people we can get premiums down?
Well, I think that if there's greater competition in the insurance market, then like in any market, that'll give consumers the opportunity to demand more competitive pricing. So I think that allowing competition across state lines is a reasonable step toward trying to get premiums under control.
Wouldn't that mean, though, to attract more insurers into the market, eliminating some of the mandates for coverage now that are in place under the Affordable Care Act, conditions that have to be covered.
I think we can allow greater competition in the market to drive down prices and drive up quality without undermining those core consumer protections. For example, protections for folks with pre-existing conditions, guarantees that women won't face price discrimination, and some medium coverage requirements, for example, for preventative health care that we know are so important to public health.
What about contraception? What about maternity care, for instance? Why should employers have to offer contraception or maternity care to some employees who wouldn't need them?
Again, we're talking about basic standards of coverage. And I think that along with those protections for folks with pre-existing conditions and women, making sure that folks who get insurance through their employer have those basic minimum standards of coverage is reasonable. But I do think we need to introduce more competition into the insurance market so that consumers can get better deals and have access to a wider range of choices.
House Democrats have so far lined up in absolute opposition to any GOP plan that's been floated so far. Isn't that a bad idea if you want to get the kind of compromise that you're talking about, which might be more acceptable to Democrats in the end than some all-Republican plan that might win final passage? Could you end up with something worse if you resist than you would get if you compromised?
Well, all I can tell you is what my approach would be. And my approach would be to look at policy and legislation on the merits. Does it serve the interests of my constituents? If it does, then I'd be inclined to support it. If I think it might but needs improvement, then I'd be inclined to work across the aisle to improve it. When it ultimately comes to the floor for a vote, I'll ask the question, does this serve the best interests of Georgia's 6th District? And if it does, I'll vote for it, and if it doesn't, I won't.
Part of that is something you've talked about, which is cutting wasteful spending. And staying on health care for a moment, let's talk about Medicaid. There was a Government Accountability Office audit that found that billions were spent on Medicaid demonstration projects. In other words, getting the word out about Medicaid to people who might get covered when people already have plenty of ways to learn about it. The GAO called for a real close look at Medicaid spending. Would you favor cutting the funding for some of those demonstration programs, even if it meant cutting the overall Medicaid budget?
Well, I haven't seen that specific study, but the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, and the Congressional Budget Office both identify huge amounts of waste, duplicative spending, improper payments throughout the federal budget every year, and Congress doesn't take action to address it because career politicians in Washington don't have any incentive to do anything about it. That's why I've outlined nearly $600 billion over the next 10 years in cuts that I think we can find based on those nonpartisan assessments so that we can make tough choices to set the right priorities: research and development, higher education, deficit reduction, national security.
Can you cut your way out of the deficit, though?
Well, in order to get our fiscal house in order, we have to tackle the long-term increase in our debt. And that means we do have to achieve deficit reduction year over year because it's not sustainable. At the same time, we have to set the right priorities domestically.
Can you achieve that overall goal, though, without the other half of the equation, which is raising revenue, increasing taxes? You can certainly find ways to cut, but is that going to be enough?
If we cut waste and then set the right priorities, like high-tech research, infrastructure, higher education, local economies like ours here in Metro Atlanta will grow more rapidly, which will improve the tax base here in this area.
That sounds like supply-side economics.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that we need a blended approach here. We need to tackle waste in the federal budget so that we can set the right priorities. Among those priorities, for example, are college affordability, making sure that our bridges and highways aren't falling down, making sure that we're prioritizing the research and development necessary to empower innovators here in this community.
So are you saying revenue increases, tax increases are off the table for you?
I wouldn't support any increases in tax rates. What I would support is eliminating the loopholes, exemptions, special treatment that large organizations and groups with lobbyists have been able to carve out of the tax code over decades because of their extraordinary access to congressional committees.
So a tax simplification bill, would you support that?
When I talk to entrepreneurs across the district, they want three things. They want certainty, they want simplicity, they want efficiency. And I'm willing to work across the aisle to achieve those things. But I think that before we start considering any of the proposals, we need independent economists in the Congressional Budget Office to tell us what the impact on the deficit and on growth would be.
Because you've talked a lot about leveling the playing field for small business, and one of the major ways that President Trump has said we could do that is to cut the corporate tax rate from 35% at the top, anyway, to 15%, and the current House plan is to have that at 20%. Won't both of those plans certainly help small businesses who really do feel the impact of the corporate tax rate?
Well, I would be interested in working across the aisle to try to relieve the tax burden for small and medium-sized businesses. But you got to look at it as well in the context of the overall tax plan that's been presented and its impact on deficits, its impact on growth. I think that small and medium-sized businesses and tax relief for them need to be at the top of the agenda. We need to make sure that any tax reform bill doesn't principally benefit only those large organizations who have lobbyists, and make sure that we're leveling the playing field for smaller organizations.
But since most corporations are actually small businesses, wouldn't a cut in the corporate tax rate really help those businesses?
And again, I'm open to working across the aisle to achieve that kind of tax relief for small and medium-sized businesses. And we got to look at it in the context of the overall tax reform proposal and what its impact on deficits and growth would be.
Are there any kind of taxes that you would increase?
I don't support any increases in tax rates. What I support is closing loopholes so that we can relieve taxes, for example, on small and medium-sized businesses.
You've talked about bringing high-tech jobs to the district particularly, but won't that mean that there will have to be tax credits for those businesses? And you've hinted at this earlier in our conversation. Won't that increase the very deficits that you're trying to cut?
Well, tax reform should close those loopholes and those subsidies for special interests to create room for tax relief for small and medium-sized businesses. And I'd also mention that one critical role that a member of Congress can play is to be an ambassador for the business community and the market here in Georgia, to go out to growing organizations and make the case that they should put their new facilities, headquarters, research centers here in Metro Atlanta. So even beyond what's happening legislatively, an energetic and fresh representative can go out and attract more business, more capital, more clients, more investment.
A lot of those high-tech jobs you've talked about, though, require some kind of education beyond high school. There are a lot of folks in the district, and particularly in some parts of the district, who are just trying to get past minimum wage. If we focus entirely on high-tech jobs that pay quite well, are we going to get enough jobs for people who need better jobs than the ones they have now?
Well, we've got to prepare young people for the kinds of jobs that are going to form the backbone of the economy here in Metro Atlanta over the next few decades. And that's why, as we seek to achieve fiscal responsibility and cut waste so we can set the right priorities, one of those priorities has to be higher education, and not just four-year bachelor's degrees, but also technical training, 2 years associate's degrees that can prepare our young people to go and apply their skills and talents in that economy.
And that's young people. But there are a lot of folks right now who may not be quite so young who are looking for jobs that in areas where those jobs don't exist anymore. What do you do for them, particularly in parts of the district where folks don't have the kind of incomes that maybe other parts of the district do?
It's a great question. And those tech schools and community colleges, those public universities and colleges, can also provide important retraining for folks who need to take a new career, need to pursue new opportunities. And if we attract more business, more opportunity here to the metro area, there'll be more opportunities for them to do so.
You've talked about working with anyone. The implication is you wouldn't just toe a Democratic Party line all the time if you were elected. But assuming you're elected now, because you're almost immediately going to be running for re-election and you will probably attract a well-funded Republican opponent, you're going to need help from that very Democratic leadership that you're implying you won't always walk in line with. They'll demand your cooperation in the House. How can you achieve that independence that you're talking about if you need their help to get reelected?
One of the things I'm proudest of is that my campaign's powered by grassroots small-dollar fundraising. The average contribution is less than $50. And there are several hundred thousand people who have contributed to the campaign. Mm-hmm. That kind of independent grassroots fundraising base gives candidates like me a level of independence.
But a lot of the ads that have gone after your opponent, Karen Handel, have come from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And true, you have had a lot of small contributions, but won't you need everything, including support from the Democratic leadership?
If you look at the vast majority of spending on the airwaves here in this district, in the metro area of the last few months, you'll see that my campaign, powered by grassroots fundraising, so I'm putting up our ads, and you'll see that outside groups from Washington, D.C., funded often anonymously by special interests in unlimited amounts, have been putting up cynical attack ads for months and months. That's the real story in terms of campaign finance here in the 6th District race. The fact that I've got this base of small-dollar grassroots contributors will allow me to exercise independent-minded leadership in a way that most members of Congress do not.
Yet if you win, you're going to be the most junior member of the minority party in the House. So how can you promise folks in the 6th that you'll be able to accomplish some of the things that you've just talked about without at least sacrificing that very independence that you're talking about? Because in order to be effective as a junior member, you've got to work within the party.
Well, I think to be effective in Congress, you have to work with colleagues from both parties. I also think that you can get a great deal done, even if you're in the minority, even if you're a relatively junior member. When I was a staffer, I was able to get things done, even when we were in the minority. It takes will. It takes some skill. I will apply my experience, 5 years as a congressional aide, understanding the legislative process, understanding how congressional oversight is conducted, to hit the ground running on day one, be an effective, independent-minded voice for this community.
Okay, so let's take an example of an area where you think you could work with the Republican majority, and let's rule out for the moment infrastructure spending. That's what the Democrats say almost universally. Aside from that, where could you work with the Republican majority right now?
Tax reform, immigration reform, fiscal responsibility, attacking waste in the federal budget. There, I think, are more areas where folks here in the 6th District agree, regardless of our political party, than cynical partisans who run these political committees in Washington would have us believe. And one of the things that will be refreshing about representing a moderate, pragmatic district like the 6th District is that I will feel empowered to work across the aisle to get things done.
Republicans have attacked your support of the Iran nuclear deal. You have called for strict enforcement of the deal. But how do we know that the enforcement is strict enough, that Iran is living up not just to the letter but to the spirit of that deal? That's something that Secretary of State Tillerson has hinted at.
Well, here we are with an agreement, a nuclear agreement, whose purpose is to restrict Iran's uranium enrichment. Between the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and its inspection capabilities, and our very significant intelligence gathering capabilities, we do have the capability to determine whether or not Iran is living up to its end of the bargain. My argument is that there should be strict, uncompromising monitoring of its compliance with its obligations to restrict uranium enrichment, and if it violates them, sanctions should snap back. And furthermore, if Iran tests ballistic missiles in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, further sanctions should be imposed.
But right now we're on a deadline about deciding whether to continue to suspend the sanctions on Iran. Do you favor continuing to suspend the sanctions for now?
That depends upon the assessment of our intelligence community and what's reported to us by the IAEA. And when that time comes, we should have a look and see whether or not Iran is in compliance. If Iran is in violation, we should snap back sanctions. If they're in compliance, then we should seek to preserve the deal.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. We have a lot more we could get to. But John Ossoff, Democratic candidate in the 6th Congressional District, thank you so much for coming in and for giving us this time. We really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure, Dennis. Hope to be back.